from England, through hundreds of years of case law history, gradually evolving and changing with time as technology advanced. So again, this is judge-made law. And because the UCC sale of goods by merchant, which is statutory, governs all of that, which we're going to get to in several weeks, this is all judge-made law. That's good in every state except Louisiana. But every state put their own little spin on it. The Michigan Supreme Court might look at something a little bit differently than the Colorado Supreme Court, but it's still all roughly the same. We inherited this from English common law. So I like my definition of a contract better than the one that's on 268. My definition of a contract is when usually two, sometimes more, but usually two parties each make a promise to be bound to do something for the other. It's a commitment. I will do this as long as you've agreed to do something else for me. We're both bound to it, and unless something happens, which we'll get to, called discharge, we're both legally bound to do what we committed to do, and if not, we can be sued and have a judgment entered against us in court. 268 gives you the elements of a contract. First, an agreement, of course. Two, between competent parties. We're going to have a whole chapter on that. Three, based upon a genuine assent. Now, in the law, they like to use words that none of us ever use. So we're going to try, as we go through this, to use words that we ordinarily use. And we usually say consent, not assent. And so based on the genuine consent of the parties, I just think that makes it a little bit clearer. That is supported by consideration. The consideration is the thing of value that has been exchanged between the parties, whether it's money, services, goods. Those are the three things that it is most of the time. But it can be other things, such as forgiveness of a debt, can be consideration. So the way I like to diagram contracts, but I think students have told me that they think it would help. A standard two-party contract, each arrow represents a commitment to provide something of value to the other party. Again, usually money, services, or goods. If the goods are come from a merchant, it's in the business of selling those goods, that's when we're going to get to the UCC several chapters. Any other kind of contracts, the common law of contracts, it's in these first several chapters is what applies. Later we're going to get to a chapter called third party contracts. On the diagram, I think I mentioned 45 degree angle a few minutes ago. You probably wondered what the hell I was talking about. We're going to have a diagram like this. There's a mutual exchange of consideration between A and B so that B will do something for C. Sometimes it's a complete triangle, as we're going to see. A provides something of value to B, so that B will provide something to C, so that C will provide something back to A. And we want to keep it simple at the start, just to give you an idea of the various possibilities we're going to have here. And we'll be chapter 18 when we get to that. Made for a lawful objective. When they say made for a lawful objective, that doesn't simply mean it's not violative of the criminal laws. There's a thing called public policy as well. Judges will refuse to enforce contracts if they think those contracts violate principles of good public policy. We're going to get to that next. Another chapter. Well, there's lots of terms here. Too many that I think that are necessary. We've got promisor, promisee, obligor, and obligee. I like to use the terms offeror and offeree when we're first negotiating a contract. Somebody makes an offer, the other party responds to the offer. They can accept the offer, in which case there's a contract, as long as it meets the other elements of a legal contract. They can reject it, fine, and we have no contract. Or they can counteroffer the contract offer. Once they counteroffer, now they've switched places. Now they're the offeror. And the original offeror is now in the position of accepting or rejecting this new offer. So I'm going to try not to use obligor, obligee, promisor, promisee as they have on the bottom of 268. We'll just call it offeror, offeree each time. Until we have a contract, and then we have two contracting parties. So these first couple chapters do have a lot of terminology in them. Page 270, classes of contracts. Formal or informal, this will not be on any kind of a test. But we do have some contracts that have seals, golden seals on them. Not the things that you have up in the creatures that you have up in the north of Canada, not those kind of seals. But these little gold seals that make contract a formal contract. That has more importance in other states than it does in Michigan. Okay, express and implied contract. Express contract is when the parties, by their words that they use in their negotiations, make it clear that they intend to be bound by a contract. Express contract is certainly going to be a written contract. But it doesn't have to be. As we're going to see, we have a whole chapter on this. Some oral contracts are legally enforceable. Some are, some aren't. Then we have implied contracts. It gets a little bit more subjective. What is an implied contract? And you're going to see different terms that mean the same thing. And we're going to try to keep, rather than having to learn three terms for one, we're going to try to keep one term for one. And we're going to call them in my class implied contracts. You're going to see other names in here. And we'll cover those when we get them. Implied contract is when the law implies that two parties should be bound by a contract to avoid an unjust enrichment, to avoid one party being able to unfairly take advantage of another by obtaining goods or services from that party, but yet then not requiring them to pay for it. In the real world, people don't just run around doing express contracts all the time. Every time you go into a gas station to fill your car up, that's an implied contract. Every single time. You can't go in and fill up your car and say, well, nobody came out and said I had to pay. Nobody came out and offered me to fill that tank up in exchange for X amount of dollars. I just saw a pump there, and I thought it was for free. Nobody came out and stopped me from leaving. I just filled my tank up and I left. Yeah, I saw some numbers up there on the sign, but then one of them was diesel, one of them was cigarettes, and I wasn't quite sure what all that was, and I didn't really pay attention. If it wasn't for the doctrine of implied contracts, people would be taking advantage of other people constantly in the marketplace, every day, all the time, all over the place. So there are times that we have to imply contracts because you don't get out of your car and walk up to the manager and say, I hereby offer you $3.09 for a gallon of your gas. Do you accept that offer? People don't act like that in the real world. They don't do that. But you know when you pull in and you get out, you know that there's an implied contractual obligation to pay because you know that those goods are not offered for free. Now contrast that with another situation called chiseling. We'll use the same gas station example to contrast it. You pull up to a service gas station. There are a few of those around, not a whole lot anymore, but we go out to some small towns sometimes, you run into those. And you say, $10, please. I want $10 a regular. You're nearing empty. You're close to empty. And the person fills up your tank. Sir? And he comes and he wants to collect $30 or whatever the hell it is. Sir, no. I said I only wanted $10. oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. But you're not going to drive off with $30 on my gas without paying for it, are you? Yes, you can, because that's chiseling. Chiseling is when somebody is attempting intentionally to force themselves on you, force their goods or services on you that you don't want, that you never reasonably indicated to them that you would want or would pay for. More examples. In the spring, Saturday morning, I don't exactly like to jump, having two jobs that I do, teaching and practicing law, I don't exactly like to jump out of bed on Saturday morning and start working immediately. Kid comes to the door, 10 o'clock in the morning, asks me if he can mow my lawn for me. Okay? Yeah, all right, go ahead. He mows. There's an implied contract there that I have to pay him. That's fine. Because there was a reasonable expectation on his part for payment for the service, and there was a reasonable understanding on my part that there'd be payment for the service. Does it the next week? Yeah, all right, yeah. I'm still kind of lazy this week. And the third week's a nice day, and I'm feeling like I want to do it this time. I want to get out there and do it. But I take off early in the morning, go to the office, and I come back, and he's already mowed it. Well, Mr. Dunn, the last 2 weeks you said I could, but I never said you can do it every single week for the whole summer. In that situation, although I probably would pay the kid, I wouldn't have to, because he went and did something without my permission. He went on my yard, on my grass, ostensibly so that I would pay him, without obtaining a reasonable understanding in advance that I would pay him for, or that I would even want him to do that. Michigan has a rule. Somebody sends something to you in the mail, and you never had any idea or understanding or agreement that you would pay for this thing, and never indicated you wanted it, it's yours. It's a gift. Because again, that's somebody trying to force something on you that you didn't indicate that you would want to pay for and wanted to be bound by it, or wanted to be responsible for having to go back to the Marin Post Office to send the thing back that you didn't want. You're in a serious car accident, and you're kind of out of it. You're taken to the hospital. Can't say, I never asked anybody to take me to the hospital. I didn't really want to go. I'll take care of myself. Maybe you weren't like real seriously injured, but certainly somebody reasonably thought you needed to go to the hospital. So they call the ambulance, go to the hospital, emergency room, you're there, and you say, this is Chiseling Hospital. I never said I would be, no. You know that when you're in an accident, when a person's in an accident and injured, the hospital is there to take care of you, and that they reasonably expect payment for that service. So it all comes down to what's fair under the circumstances, and a lot of you can draw on your own life experiences and common sense to determine this. And what reasonable expectations do we have when services are rendered for us, to us? Okay, valid and avoidable and void agreements. Get some more terminology. Valid contract, of course, is an agreement that is binding and enforceable. We have two other kinds, voidable and void. We're going to see this in several chapters of contracts. A voidable contract is unenforceable by one of the two parties. When I say unenforceable, they try to go to court to sue the other party to get them to comply, they will, one of the two parties, not both, and I'll explain that in a minute, can't enforce it. The judge won't let them enforce it. Boy, neither party may enforce it. And this is all for public policy reasons. In fact, the whole law of contracts developed try to further good public policy in the marketplace, to further good faith and reasonableness between business people consumers and business people in the marketplace to foster good policies and fair dealing. The law of contracts developed on this basis. And so when we say unenforceable for public policy reasons, there's bad conduct in the marketplace that the court doesn't want to encourage by enforcing the contract that was the product of. So with avoidable, you got one bad party and one good party. One trying to defraud the other. One trying to take advantage of the other. One deceiving the other. One trying to charge an illegal rate of interest to the other. But if the innocent party, the one that hasn't engaged in any wrongdoing, wants to go to court to enforce it, that will be enforced because the purpose of these rules is to protect them. So they still want the contract, even though the court wouldn't enforce it if the other guy tried to enforce it. The court still will. Now think back to when we talked about equity on the first night of class. Equitable remedies, equitable defenses. When you go to court to try to enforce a contract, that's an equitable remedy. Only a judge will decide that, not a jury. Because juries, again, only decide money damage cases in civil courts, but not small claims. And remember one of the equitable defenses, unclean hands. That's all the stuff all fits together. Principles of equity and civil procedure with contract law, it all fits together. So if a party tries to deceive the other one into entering into a contract, and then trying to go and enforce it, basically the court would be enforcing fraud. The court won't enforce it, will cite the unclean hands doctrine and tell that party to get out of court. So that. This thing over here, the contract, is really a meeting of the minds. When A and B both have the same understanding as to what the subject matter is in the contract, and it's a lawful subject matter, and they're competent parties, and they intend to be bound, the court will enforce it as a legal contract. Certain kind of contracts are so bad that even if one party wanted to enforce it, the court wouldn't. Hitman contract. No. Neither party can enforce a hitman contract. This even spills over into domestic relations law because a marriage is like a contract. If you had one party that was already married to somebody else, and the innocent party tried to enforce that marriage contract, the innocent party couldn't. Because that couldn't be enforced by either party, void. And when we get to that chapter, we'll go over which ones are void and which ones are voidable. It'll be the battle of the voids versus the voidables. Page 272, executed and executory contract. And of course, an executed is a hitman contract. An executed contract is one that's been fully performed by both parties. Fully performed by both parties, which means that each party is entitled to receive their consideration from the other. An executory contract is one in which the parties have agreed that performance is not to be extemporaneous. In other words, right now. Most contracts have. I give you money, you perform me services. I give you money, you give me the goods at your store. I give you money, you give me the dinner at the restaurant. Most contracts are assumed to be contemporaneous. I think I said extemporaneous. Contemporaneous unless otherwise agreed. But the parties may agree to an executory contract where even though I'm giving you my consideration now, you don't have to give me yours until sometime off into the future.
Like dinner?
What's that?
Like when I go to Applebee's and eat dinner, they form their end of the contract before I agree to pay them?
Yeah, but that's going to be executed contract because you're not going to say, I just came in to sit down at your table, I'm going to pay a check, and you give me dinner in 3 weeks. People don't do that.
No, I was talking about like...
But many contracts are executory contracts.
It wouldn't be
land
like
contracts, for example. our executory contracts. Financing agreements, when you're making payments on a car, or you're making, or a business is making payments on their inventory with a bank, that's taken back a security interest to secure it. Those are all executory contracts.
Yep. I'm confused because you said that executory is just from one side, you know, like does, couldn't that like...
Performance is to be into the future, not contemporaneous with the exchange of consideration.
So it only works with the performance in the future, it's not money in the future.
No, it can be services, it can be labor, and it can be cash.
So
it can be forgiveness of a debt.
So wouldn't the one thing still count as it because you're technically, they're going to give you food first, and then sometime after you eat within a reasonable time, you're giving them cash for it if it satisfies?
Some places you have to pay in advance. So every time the restaurant does that, they've given you food on credit, and a bar tab on credit.
Yeah.
Right. If they're taking a chance, so you don't walk out. But you have an implied in law contract to pay the tab.
All right. So it'd still be the first one, though?
What's that?
It still would be the first one, not the second one, when you go in somewhere and they have a tab?
Yeah, that's going to be an executed contract. Right. Even though it's not necessarily simultaneous, it's within a very short time.
All right. So it has to be actually like
very
long time. All right.
I run out big tabs at the Bennigan's, but I never walked out on one yet. Okay. Bilateral and unilateral contracts. The next item, as we learn all this contract terminology tonight. Bilateral contract is when, back to our diagram up here, we'll say that A was the original offeror, and we'll say that B was the original offeree. B communicated their acceptance back to A. So A knew at the precise point in time when he had a contract, when B accepted. Unilateral contracts are a little bit different. In a unilateral contract, the offeror is not expecting communicated acceptance back to him. So if I say to you, Tony, if I say to you, I'll pay you $1,000 if you swim across the Saginaw Bay in your bikini. I'm saying to you, you don't have to communicate that acceptance back to me in order for me to know that we have a legally binding contract. I'm saying, you perform the act, you're entitled to the money. That's a unilateral contract. Go get me the paper. Bring it back. I give you $10. All he has to do is go get the paper and bring it back, and I got to give him the $10. Because his acceptance was the performance of the act, not on a communicated acceptance to my verbal offer. Because sometimes that's the way people operate. And again, these rules are trying to prevent unjust enrichment, somebody taking advantage of somebody else without the responsibility for paying. And so if you couch your contract offer in such a way that that other party reasonably believes they can accept it just by performing the act back, or just by delivering some goods to you, without saying they're going to deliver the goods to you, that's a legally enforceable unilateral contract. Any question about any of these things so far? Please do not hesitate. Okay. Option and first refusal contract. An option contract is when the parties agree, you see this in real estate quite a bit. Anybody in here that works in real estate? Is when the parties agree to hold a piece of property open, doesn't have to be property, it frequently is, hold a piece of property open for a period of time and not so that the offeror will agree not to sell the property to anybody else for a certain length of time. So let's identify what our arrows are in that situation. In this situation, B pays A $5,000. A agrees back to B, I'll hold this open for you for a year. I know you can't get the financing right now, I know there's some things you have to get off your credit, You got to show a year of not being late on a house payment in order to get that mortgage that you want at that rate of interest. I understand that. And I want to help you. But if B was not willing to pay money just for holding the property for a year, that wouldn't be a legally binding promise on A's part. It would be a nice thing, it would be a nice gesture, it would be, in the term they use in the book, gratuitous. Nice, gratuitous gesture. Gratuitous is like a gift. Something nice you've done for somebody, like a gift, but there's no, in a gift situation, there's no reasonable expectation of payment in return, because if there was, it'd be a contract, not a gift. Okay? So if A wasn't getting anything for it, A could make that promise to B. Hey, B, I'll hold that property open for you for a year. But there's nothing to bind it if there's not consideration back to A to hold it. If B pays $5,000 to A to hold that property, now A's got to hold it, because otherwise he's in breach of contract. If he goes and sells it to somebody else during that year, then B can go into a Michigan Circuit Court, obtain an equitable remedy, specific performance. One of the many equitable remedies we're going to be talking about as we go along here. Somebody had a hand up over here. Adam, is that you over here? Somebody. Michael?
Mm-hmm. Say you and I enter into a contract that I want to buy your house or your storefront or something. We can't enter into a binding contract if I say, okay, I want to buy your property pending the sale of.
That's a different deal. That is called, we're going to get to that, conditional contract. But there still has to be an exchange of consideration. But the parties understand that until the condition occurs, nobody's bound by the contract. A lot of people that work for Dow that think they're going to be transferred, this happened years ago, when a whole bunch of them thought they were going to be transferred to Indianapolis. And so there's a listing agreement on their house. They weren't quite sure they were going to, and they listed it, but they weren't quite sure they were going to end up going to Indianapolis. And certainly they didn't know when they were going to go to Indianapolis, but they heard they were going there. So some of them signed listing agreements, which is a contract with you and the realtor. And if that realtor sells that house, they get their title of that commission. If the price that matches the price in the listing agreement is offered, and that offer is secured by the realtor is entitled to their commission, whether the house is sold or not. That's the realtor's contract with the party that listed. So the conditional agreement is, everybody understands that unless Dow transfers me to Indianapolis, I don't want to sell my house. Conditional contract. Happens all the time.
But there's got to be money that changes hands when that contract is entered into?
No, not in this situation.
But on the option contract,
yes.
It has to be money.
In fact, this building was the subject of a famous option contract back in 1988. At that time, I was on the, and I'm not a member of that church anymore, but I was on the Blessed Sacrament Parish Council. John Rapanos wanted this building. This building was owned by Blessed Sacrament at the time. Delta College wanted the building too back then. John Rapanos said, well, I will show you how serious I am. Here's $10,000. Here's $10,000. The building was going to be sold for about $1 million. That's great. So we accepted the $10,000. And then negotiated it later. The $10,000 was an option contract that everybody signed. John Rapanos didn't think we were sharp enough to be able to figure out what an option contract was. So when he ultimately came up with the financing and was ready to do the deal, he wanted to bring a check for $990,000. He wanted to deduct the $10,000, and he considered that in advance. No. We had to explain to him, no. That was so that we wouldn't sell it to Delta College during that period of time when you're trying to come up with that financing.
So that $10,000 then became...
Separate contract. Just so we wouldn't sell... $10,000 here, we won't sell the Delta here.
Okay.
Okay.
Is that what bought in the little corner office over here?
Yeah. So ultimately it all worked out because he ended up renting the part of the building to Delta and everybody was happy. So.
So who owns this building then now? Delta or that guy?
What's that?
Who owns the building now then? Straight out.
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I think the Rapanos is the one. I think Delta rents it from the Rapanos. Am I right about that? Anybody know the answer?
I never even heard of that.
There's that term I was looking for earlier, 273. Quasi contract. Means the same thing as implied contract. I didn't want you to get intimidated and overloaded with the terminology here. So what you should probably write with a pencil next to that is implied contract. Means the same thing. In some cases, a court will impose an obligation even though there is no contract. The obligation is called a quasi contract. Why the publisher of the book, when we're not law students, wants us to learn two and three terms for everything when they mean the same thing, we're not going to do that. Prevention of unjust enrichment. Page 274, there's a little contract there. I used to draft contracts earlier in my career. I don't really do it too much anymore, except in case. I guess I'm not perceived as that kind of a lawyer who does that.
What was a conditional contract?
Conditional contract is when the parties agree that when a certain incident or event or condition occurs, they're bound by the contract. You see a lot of this also in contracts of people starting businesses. If I get that bank loan that I'm trying to get, I will lease your building or I will purchase this inventory from you. No, the option contract is when you're paying somebody to hold something for you. And so in that situation, in the example that you brought up, if it was, maybe it probably wasn't a good example I used. If it was holding a building for somebody, then that's an option contract.
I get that. And the conditional is...
I will buy that inventory from you if I get my bank loan approved next Thursday. Okay. Contracting on the internet, 278, all the same rules apply. When you do it. Alright, just follow into chapter 13. We'll come back and do those problems after 12 next week. Requirements of an offer. It has to be something specific, reasonably can be accepted, and the offer has to be made to the person that wants to accept it. They might say, well, what's that about? Public offers is where this comes in. Yeah. Chapter 13 in offers. The only person that can accept an offer is the one to whom it's been made. A public offer is made to anybody, any member of the public. Can't discriminate. Certainly since the Civil Rights Act of 1965, you can't say only certain people can come in my store. Public offer is made to every member of the public.
Is that like when Louisiana has Hurricane Katrina? There's a bunch of rich landowners that tried to sell their house that said that they could only sell their house to, someone who was a blood relative, but they didn't offer it, I guess, to the public. Is that a violation of that? Or?
Yeah, I'm sure. Of course, Louisiana doesn't have common law. French civil codes, they never had English common law. But you can't discriminate because there's civil rights statutes and stuff like that. But in a case of Katrina, I mean, that was a...
No, what they were trying to do is keep everything still segregated in the park. That's where the elite folks live. They wanted only someone who was a relative.
Anybody that's capable of buying the property, you can't stop them from doing that. discrimination.
But don't you also, like, I'm not disagreeing with you, because I've been kicked out of a shop or two for nothing, just because the establishment said that we have the right to refuse to, like, do business with anybody of our choice or something like that?
You can't force somebody to enter into a contract with you as a general principle. But by the same token, a person can't be discriminated against because of their race or religious background. Discrimination is when you can establish a pattern that the same people are being denied something over and over and over again.
So if I have a house...
So I can't, just because I want to enter into a contract with you, Mr. Henry, you're free to say no, because it's a free country. You don't have to enter into a contract with me if I don't want to enter into a contract with you.
Then if the guy is selling his house in a rich part of the thing, and some guy walks up to me and says, hey, I'm going to give you your asking price, and I say, no, I don't want to sell my house to you, isn't that okay?
When you say asking price, did you have a listing agreement with a realtor in that situation?
I'm assuming so.
Because if you didn't list the house, you don't have to sell it to anybody.
If you're listing...
Except the government. The eminent domain provisions
Even if you're listing the house under a realtor and a guy comes up and says, I'll give you the offering price, can you
if you list the property with a realtor and somebody comes up and says, I've got that money, I want to accept that offer, if you don't sell it to them, you're going to be sued by the realtor for that 70%. Because you're breaching your contract with the realtor.
All right, so unless you have a separate contract with the realtor.
And that party will go to the circuit court and try to get the equitable remedy against you to force you to sell them. That's only going to be after there's an offer of purchase signed by the court.
There's no way around it if it's listed to look at somebody and say, I don't want to sell to you because of blah, blah, blah.
Sure, you could say, I don't want to sell to you because of blah, 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 blah. They might go away and say, okay. Or they might try to drag you into circuit court, but if you and them haven't signed an offer to purchase, then your breach of contract is going to be with that realtor, because they're entitled to their commission.
All right.
An offer also needs to be contrasted with an offer, an invitation to negotiate. Don't confuse the two. So if you say, so if I say to Mr. Henry, what will you pay for my 2008 Pontiac G6 out in the park? What would you pay me for that? Is that a contract offer or is that an invitation to negotiate?
That's an invitation.
That's an invitation to negotiate. I'm not making it clear that I would sell to you at any price you come up with. What I'm trying to do is find out what my car is worth by doing that. Definiteness on page 286. An offer has to be definite and certain. It can't be indefinite or vague. Again, because the contract is going to be this meeting of the minds. And so what you really have to make it definite and certain are the basics. Well, I would say the basics are quantity and price. How much of this thing, whatever it is, am I getting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or what am I getting? And what's the price? And is this going to be contemporaneous exchange of money for goods, or are we talking about some kind of finance agreement or executory contract? Are we talking about some part of the money down and some down and later? We're talking about all the money now. You'd have to know that for it to be definite enough to be a legally enforceable contract. Chart here on 289. You get offer, acceptance, yes, contract form. You get offer, counter offer, no. This counteroffer brings us to this idea of the mirror image rule. This is kind of an archaic common law rule, but it still exists. The response to the contract offer has to be the mirror image of the offer itself. You can't add anything to it. So if somebody said, what will you pay me for these lemons, these crates of lemons and limes that I have here? The mirror image rule requires just a response to that. I will pay you $100 for each one. Okay, we got a deal. When the response goes beyond the offer, it becomes a counteroffer, which destroys, actually, two words, not one. Destroys the power to accept the original offer. So the parties are now turned around, and the original offeree is now the offeror because they made a counteroffer. And when they made that counteroffer, they're saying, forget that original offer. That's out of the question. Whether they say that or not, legally that's what they're saying. Will you accept my counteroffer? That's the mirror image rule. Also in the mirror image rule, you can only accept the offer through the same method that the offer was made, unless the parties otherwise agree. So this is how archaic these rules are. So if I sent you the offer by mail, you could only respond by mail. If I sent it to you by carrier pigeon, you can only accept by tucking that little note under the wing of the carrier pigeon and sending it back out the window. Fax to fax, phone to phone. You'll see that ridiculous rule changes when we get to the UCC sale of goods by merchants. They see those kind of things. Unless the parties agree that the offeree can accept by some other means.
So if somebody faxed something to you and say it was a deal and says you can either fax or call, that's
right.
Saying that...
If the offeror has the right to say how the contract is going to be accepted. So if the offeror says by fax or call, then that's the only way you can accept. Talk about the mailbox rule. Everything except the acceptance is effective when received. When I say effective, determines whether we have a contract. So an offer is effective when it's received. A counteroffer is effective when it's received. But acceptance is subject to this mailbox rule. When sent, acceptance is effective legally to determine whether or not we have a contract. When sent, not when received. So when you drop that envelope in the mailbox, when the carrier pigeon goes out the window, when you hit the send button on the internet for your email, if you're going to do it by email, that's when your acceptance is effective. So if you're going to be in the business of contracts, you might want to keep that in mind. So in other words, your acceptance doesn't create a contract once the other party receives it. Your acceptance creates a contract when you send it. When you hit the send button, when you drop the envelope in the mailbox, whichever method you use.
So if I had a paper contract and I signed it, didn't actually deliver it anywhere, maybe I was going to mail it from the office. On the way to the office, I get run over by a car and killed. Is that signed contract valid?
Not if it wasn't sent.
Even though I never sent it? Okay.
Not if it wasn't sent. It wouldn't be binding anyway because your death discharges the contract. But this is important because sometimes you're dealing with somebody who's dealing with a whole bunch of other people. And you want to lock them into something and he wants to say, well, I didn't get it. So, and there's that length of inventory. You thought you were getting that inventory in the showroom, and you sent the acceptance back. Your acceptance is effective when you sent, but you got to be able to prove in court when you sent it. If he then got rid of that inventory after you sent your acceptance through the mail, and he breached his contract with you.
So as long as
because the subject matter, he got rid of it to somebody else, he'd be able to sue him for breach.
So as long as you can prove that you sent it, you're good to go.
Right. With email, this doesn't create as many problems as it used to. But of course, if you are going to send something in the mail, you should immediately follow it up with an email. I just sent it at 3:16 p.m. I dropped it in the mailbox, your acceptance, at 3:16 p.m. This memo is to confirm that for your reference. Always do that. No phone calls. Forget that. Phone calls mean zip.
Can't you get a receipt?
Chances of somebody actually remembering when you made a call and exactly what you said to somebody else on the phone as it got passed to three other people. You can't rely on phone calls.
Can you also, when you drop, instead of dropping in the mailbox, go right into the mail post office and get a receipt from the postmaster?
That's even better yet. That's even better yet, right?
I had a question about this one because it happened. If I'm talking to a company on the telephone, and they tell me, I spoke to Allied Waste. I have dumpsters out of my apartment. And I spoke to Allied Waste and said, you know, I need this dumpster here, and I know it's going to cost me $50 a month, and if I'm not happy with your service, I want you to take it away. They want you to sign a year's contract. And I said, well, I really don't want to sign this year's contract because I'm not sure I'm going to be happy with what you're going to do for me.
You didn't sign it?
I did sign it, but the lady told me, she said, while we were sitting right there, she said, Mike, if you're not happy with our services, I'll come get that dumpster and we'll take it away.
You've got to include that oral promise in the written contract.
Okay.
They need to include that in the written contract that you sign.
It doesn't have to be an oral contract?
You can have both an oral understanding modifying the written contract and the written contract itself, because once you get to court later on, it's only going to be that written contract that anybody's going to remember and anybody's going to try and enforce. She's never going to admit that she ever made that statement to you if you end up in court.
Well, you know what the kicker is? She did. And they still jam me. I told them to come get the dumpster.
We're in a subjective area. I mean, there is, and we're going to get to this later, satisfaction absolutely guaranteed or satisfy or your money back. And things are worded in different ways. But you can't take advantage of that, because that can become chiseling. Taking advantage of language like that, even though it really wasn't that bad, it wasn't the greatest, but it was decent, but you still say, I still want my money back because I wasn't completely satisfied, so give me my money back. So there's an obligation of good faith in these performance, money back, and guaranteed contracts that a court will hold you to. Right. Any question about the mailbox rule? Acceptance is effective when sent. Because businesses sometimes are sending things out to different people. And so you have to be able to have a rule that it determines at any one point in time when did the contract become enforceable. An offer, but there's no contractual intent. No contract even if accepted. Because there has to be a meeting of the minds between two parties, each of whom intend to be bound by a contract before you can have one. So just basically messing with somebody or screwing around and sort of talking about a contract but never really wanting one doesn't create a contract, but I don't recommend doing that because the judge might decide differently. If it's not definite, it can be accepted. If there's no acceptance, you don't have a contract. If you have an acceptance after an invitation to negotiate, you don't have a contract. Once the offer has been terminated, you can't accept it. Any offer that's not yet been accepted can be terminated before it's accepted. And back to this idea of public offers. Newspaper has an ad. Molly Cyrus dresses at Kohl's for $50 a piece on Saturday morning. And they realize they only have about 20 of those dresses and they didn't want to offer it at that price. Because they don't want all these ladies showing up to buy those dresses. They want to revoke the offer. so they're not stuck with all those unhappy customers coming to the store on Saturday morning. As long as the revocation of that offer is utilized as comparable means of publicity, a public revocation of an offer not yet accepted is effective to revoke the offer. Get this idea of a rain check. You ever heard that term? That means somebody owes you something. See, in a public offer situation, your response, your acceptance of that public offer is to show up at that store on Saturday morning. That's your consideration. I came here with the money. I could have been in Birch Run. I could have been down at the Novi Mall, which is, I get dragged down there once in a while. I don't really want to go. But instead, I came here, and I stood in line, and I waited for your store to open at 10 o'clock. So that's my consideration for acceptance of your public offer. The store doesn't want that to happen, and so they revoke it. And as long as they use comparable publicity. So if the offer was on TV5, the revocation has to be on TV5. If the offer was on if the offer's on TV5, you can't put the revocation in the shopper's guide. Okay? Got to be comparable publicity, the revocation of the offer as opposed to the offer, because if not, that store has breached the contract and owes those rain checks to those people, which is basically a remedy for a breach of a contract. Well, I'll get you next.
So is that the reason why some of them say at the bottom of they put that disclaimer, you know, only will it purchase from
right.
The stores?
They're trying to protect themselves. And so they would say, first come, first served, limited supply. That'll do.
So if they didn't want to sell all those items, they could just pull them off the floor, sell one or two of them, and say, oh, they were hurt.
They can't say to women only.
No, I mean, they could pull
you
them off the
floor.
You
know why they would do
that,
don't you?
They were all sold already. And then a couple weeks later, after the thing passed, they could bring them back out again.
You know why they would say to women only, don't you? Because guys have a tendency to just go in and buy one thing and get the hell out of the store. Women have a tendency to take more time, be more patient, compare things, and maybe be in there to buy other things in the store. We do have a problem after the chapter when that very thing happened. So, if they don't protect themselves, then they breach contracts with anybody who shows up. If they have made it clear that it's first come, first served, limited supply, and almost like the first 20 or the first 50 only will get the dresses, then they protected themselves. Then the people that want to accept it know they've got to be the first 20 to get there to be able to accept the offer.
What about encouragement?
Okay. Where are we now? Best efforts clauses on page 290. That's sort of like Mike's example.
I sort of question real quick on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you said equal means of publication for your rejection or like saying no offer.
Yeah, we revoke the offer.
So if you put it in the Sunday paper, is a Monday paper equivalent to a Sunday paper?
No. Because a lot more people stay home on Sunday than on Monday. They work on Monday.
That's what I thought.
Sunday paper's got a whole lot more in it to justify sitting down there and going through it.
Would the vice versa be true? If you put it in Monday, can you put the retraction in Sunday? That has a larger...
The following Sunday?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
But it's got to be that only, not if the, if we were talking about the sale being on Sunday.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's got to still be reasonably in advance. Best efforts clauses? Now, when you get into the subjective stuff, you run into problems. I will use my best efforts to market your product. You pay me X amount of dollars. You can run into a lot of problems as to what are best efforts there. I won't have best efforts on the test. Divisible contracts. Contracts can be divisible. Where even if there's a breach on part of it, the other part isn't, and the other part could be enforced. Here's what is more important, and I do run into this quite a bit in business. Requirements and outputs contracts. Page 290. There's a term that you deal with when the problem you have in trying to determine what the meeting of the minds was, you can't really determine what a party is actually obligated to themselves to do. I will buy all of your products that I want. How do we know that at the time you're signing the contract? How many do you want? I'm going to buy so many of your items that I believe I can use in my business. How do we know that? We don't. Sometimes this is referred to as smoke and mirrors, where you can't, even at first glance, it might appear like there's an intention to be into a contract, but then if you look at the language a little bit more closely, and you can't really determine what somebody's actually obligated to do. That's the general rule. Illusory agreements are not legally enforceable. Outputs and requirements are exceptions, because these are contracts almost always between businesses, not between the little Joe Smith consumer and a big company, but a contracts between businesses. And the courts, as this common law evolved, as the capitalist system in the United States developed and advanced, particularly into the 20th century, the court said, we got to let the businesses figure things out to some extent. We got to let the big boys take care of themselves in the marketplace and not interfere. And so if one business said to another, I will take care of all of the requirements of your business. My business can take care of your business exclusively. You're not going to need to buy any of your materials from anybody else. Any of your products, materials, nuts, bolts, screws, metal, anything that you need, I can provide to you at this price. You'd say, well, that sounds like an illusory agreement. That sounds like smoke and mirrors. Yeah, maybe it is. Except the court assumed that each business has done some reasonable investigation of the other to be able to know what it is they have to supply, and they've made that determination that they can do it. So why prevent people from going into those contracts? Because each side benefits from that, and if each side benefits from that, then you have mutuality of consideration. You've got the two arrows. On the one hand, one party has a guaranteed market, does not have to go out in the marketplace and hire people and compare prices and hustle and do all this other stuff because everything is provided, and the other one has an absolute guarantee for all the business that they can handle. So, and what else do you do by doing that? You lock out your competitors. There's not going to be any other competitor because I'm going to be dealing with you exclusively. You're not going to need anything from any of my competitors because I'm going to provide it all to you at this price. None of your other competitors can do that. So one of them might provide this, another one maybe this, another one that. I can provide all of it to you at this price if you sign an exclusive dealing with me. Outputs contract is just a little bit different spin on that. You have a plant, you have a factory, you're producing products. I'll buy every single one of them. Every single one that your plant can put out on the line, I will buy. So on the one hand, one party has a guaranteed customer for everything that they can do, and they don't have to spend money on marketing. On the other hand, the other party locked out all of his competitors. Each side got something. Even though, yeah, it kind of was illusory, but they're big boys, they're companies, they've researched, and they figured out they can do it, and they figured that was a risk they can take. And if they want to take that risk, that's all what capitalism is all about, taking risks in the marketplace. Leave them alone and don't apply these archaic common law rules to prevent them from doing that. That's the idea there. Any questions about that?
Do the quantities have to be somewhat reasonable?
Yes. Yeah, very good point. There is always going to be an obligation of good faith built in. So if you have to go to circuit court for an equitable remedy to enforce the contract, that's called the specific performance remedy, or the circuit court to get an order rescinding the contract, tear it up, also an equitable remedy, there's always an obligation of good faith. So if the court found that one party made an unreasonable demand on the other, that they knew the other party couldn't fulfill, the court won't enforce the contract. And what would that be called if it was raised as a defense? Unclear. clean hands. Okay? Equity rules, contract rules, they fit together. Okay, 292, revocation of the offer. No particular form or words are required to constitute the revocation. Any words indicating the offeror's termination of the offer are sufficient. Option contracts, firm offers. I even mentioned those, but we don't get to those until we get to the UCC. That's one of the changes that the UCC made in sale of goods by merchants. Firm offers. So we'll wait until we get there to talk about that. Counteroffer, rejection of offer. Okay, so there's a number of things that can happen that can prevent somebody from accepting an offer. One of them we just talked about, revocation. The other one with Lucas, the guy died. Definitely, all of these things have to take place before the contract offer is accepted. The death of the offeror was one. Revocation by the offeror before the contract was accepted was another one. As long as that revocation is effective, and that's not effective until received either. So the only thing that's effective when sent is the acceptance. Revocation is not effective until received. The other thing that will be lapse, just a second, I'll get to the question. Lapse of time. Contract offers are only open for a reasonable period of time. Go ahead, question.
What did you say about, just before that, you said something about, forgot already.
So, if the revocation is sent before it's accepted, or the offeror dies before it's accepted, or the offeree waited too long to accept, waiting too long might be latches in terms of an equitable remedy in court, right?
So this is like
90 days. I've seen many courts issue decisions that use 90 days as a rule of thumb. However, it just depends on the contract. If you're talking about perishable goods, it isn't going to be 90 days because everybody knows bananas rot. So if it's a contract, produce rots. So if it's a contract for bananas, you probably an offer of a contract to buy bananas for a retail outlet, you probably have a day to respond. One day.
Would this be like cancellation?
Because you got to get those bananas on the shelf and they're still a little bit green. Somebody have a point back here?
No, I was just a question. So this is like a cancellation of an offer? Or
that's revocation. Same thing.
All right, so it's
just a different word. And the other thing is that the offeror may condition the offer on a certain length of time. You can only accept this within the next 2 days. I must hear something from you by midnight tomorrow. If I don't hear your response by midnight tomorrow, I cannot accept it. So that would be a lapse of time contained right in the offer. Subsequent illegality, page 294, doesn't come up very often. But you made a contract offer and suddenly the contract cannot be accepted because the subject matter is unlawful. Or the whole purpose of the contract is to destroy it. Let's say you are sending goods from overseas back to the United States. You work for a foreign company. And the goods that are coming across on the ship have been taken over by pirates. Those goods cannot arrive. So you cannot any longer, once the ship has been destroyed or taken over, you cannot accept a contract for the purchase of those goods. Silence is acceptance on page 296. I don't recommend that. Don't ever not, if you have an offer sent to you, don't ever just not respond. You either respond with a counteroffer, you respond with a rejection, or you respond with an acceptance. because there are some arguments that a party can make on that silence that they reasonably believe was an acceptance based upon prior dealings of the parties. Okay, 298, actually I jumped ahead, the mailbox rule on 298.
I have one question real quick about the silence of exception. I have one question about that silence of acceptance thing. So, the only way that items can be exception is if you've done prior business with the other company.
If you gave the other party a reasonable basis to believe that unless they heard back from you, they want it. You want it.
So, like, if you
gave them that impression, then your silence could be construed as an exception.
So, if I was running a small business and I get an envelope from such and such company and I never even heard of them, I go, I don't even know who these guys are, I throw them in the garbage, never even heard of them, never even talked to them in my life. And I just throw that envelope with that seal on it in the garbage.
Yeah, right. Just like I said earlier, somebody sends you something you didn't order, it's yours, it's a gift.
Right, so
unless you gave them the impression that you wanted that.
Right.
Columbia House would be a good example of that, right? You used to do that all the time. Columbia House used to do that all the time. Right?
Right. Last thing tonight, auction sales. Simple rule.
300.
An auction is either with reserve or without reserve. Now, in an auction, who's the offeror in the auction situation? Who's the offeror? And who's the offeree? Who's the offeree in the auction? The auctioneer is the offeree. He's getting offers for goods, and he's an agent for the sales, the agent for the owner. He's getting offers from people to buy it. When an auction is with reserve, the auctioneer has the right when the bidding is not coming up to market price that they anticipated. The auctioneer can remove the goods from the auction. You say, nope, sorry. We'll have to come back another day. We're not getting this price bid up. We don't have enough competition here to bid this price up. Forget it. Thank you for coming, and we're going home. But if an auction is without reserve, which any auction is deemed to be, because this was the common law rule, unless otherwise stated in the public notice, the auction is deemed to be without reserve. That means when Maxwell Silver Hammer, that old song by the Beatles, comes down a third time after somebody made a bid, that's it, you got a contract. Because they're without reserve, because the auctioneer cannot remove them from the sale when there aren't people there to bid the price up enough. And so if you're the auction, or you're the person that wants to have your stuff sold at an auction, please make it be with reserve. Don't put yourself in this position. And make sure you indicate that in the public notice that it's going to be with reserve. So you're not stuck, even though you wanted it to be without reserve, you're not forced to do this. Because those people who come to those auctions, they're shrewd. They know what the rules are. And if they came there and the notice didn't say with reserve, and they're the highest bidder, it's a contract. Because the offer in a without reserve auction is, here's these goods. The person among you who bids the highest, it's yours. Those are the rules. Okay, so when we come back next week, we got problems 12, problems 13. We're going to go up and down the aisles again, just like we did with torts. Then, when we're done with the problems, we'll go over this test tonight, too. Then we'll get into chapter 14. Please, if you didn't do well tonight, just 1 second. Don't hang your head. Final exam is way double the percent average.